Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
In the spotlight is William Styron, the famed author of novels that included Sophie's Choice and The Confessions of Nat Turner. And joining William Styron in that spotlight is Styron biographer Jim West, professor of English emeritus at Penn State University. He is a biographer and book historian and the author of several books, including William Styron, A Life. West has held fellowships from the J.S. Guggenheim Foundation, the National Humanities Center, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. He has had Fulbright appointments in England at Cambridge University and in Belgium at a university whose name I'm not going to pronounce correctly. So let's just say a Fulbright that took him to Belgium. And he has been a visiting fellow at the American Academy in Rome. So we will be discussing William Styron, who was one of the most prominent and successful novelists of his generation. He was the author of four full-length novels, Lie Down in Darkness. That was his first one way back in 1951, an early success for him that we'll talk about. Set This House on Fire in 1960. The Confessions of Nat Turner appeared in 1967, won the Pulitzer Prize. I do believe Jim will check me on this. And Sophie's Choice. Both of those made into movies, award winners. His other books include a volume of essays titled The Quiet Dust. He also wrote a book called Darkness Visible that we'll talk about this devastating bout of depression that he went through. And it was more than one round of it at that. And he also has a volume of short fiction titled A Tidewater Morning, which published in 1993. So as I was saying, he won several major awards, including the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. With that, Jim West, welcome to the program.
Hello, Mike. Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
No, we're happy to have you. You know, before we launch into William Styron, I'm just curious, being that you're on Penn State, one of my favorite professors from Arizona State, left there to go to Penn State to head the journalism program. His name is Doug Anderson. Did you happen to cross paths with Doug Anderson?
I did know Doug, yes. I've been retired now for 5 or 6 years, but we did cross paths. We're fairly close in discipline, and I think we might have suffered through some committee meetings together.
Yeah, I believe Doug moved back to Arizona after he retired, so he's back in the warm climate. Good to know. I'll let Doug know that you and I, we've crossed paths and about the podcast. Hopefully he'll listen in. Just in terms of William Styron, I do want to start by talking about the depression that he suffered. He wrote this book called, when he was just 26 years old, his first novel, well-received. It was called Lie Down in Darkness. Again, published in 51, a brooding lyrical meditation on a young Southern girl's suicide. So then years later, many years later, he ends up writing a nonfiction book called Darkness Visible about his own devastating bouts of depression, and which he went through several rounds of, is my understanding. And my background research on William Styron suggests that he had always been a drinker. He had kept his kind of demons at bay by self-medicating with alcohol. But that change, I mean, like anything else, over time, especially something like alcohol or a drug, just doesn't work anymore or does more harm than good. And he did sink into some very serious depression, suicidal style depression, although he never did kill himself, fortunately. Talk a little bit about what you know about the depression he suffered, Jim, and how did that play into his writing? I mean, obviously he wrote that nonfiction book, but what about did it influence a lot of his other work as well?
I think probably all of it. After Styron went through that first bout of depression, he went back and reviewed his writings, his fiction, and all that he had published over a long career, and he felt correctly, I believe, that there had been echoes or forebodings of depression. In all of that writing, I think it's good to make the connection with Lie Down in Darkness, but you certainly see it in the other writings as well. Styron went through that first period of depression when I was in England. I had a year there, and I did not actually see him then, but we corresponded, and at that point, I did not know what has since come to be called affective illness. I did not know that term. I think many people did not. One of the important things that Darkness Visible did was to call attention to depression, not as a failing of character, but rather as a disease, an affliction. And of course, Styron commanded the English language in such a way that he could make that affliction apparent to people. He could explain, he could give voice to what many of those who suffer from depression feel. So that's maybe the most important thing that book did. It is a powerful little book.
Now, what was it? Is there anything about his life from the past that suggested that this might be the cause of the depression? I mean, maybe it was just a chemical imbalance, and maybe it's genetic. Was there anything about his upbringing or his early life that suggested that maybe this was a trigger point?
Well, it's difficult to know. The causes of depression differ from person to person. The etiology of the disease also differs among sufferers. But when Styron was 14 years old, his mother died from cancer after a long period of suffering. He was not aware of what she was going through until perhaps 2 years before the end. But that's a difficult time to lose a parent. And that might have been one of the reasons. Another reason you alluded to was Styron's drinking, but he never felt that he was out of control with his drinking. And I would have to agree. I certainly sat many nights with him. And I had the bottle of Jack Daniels, and he had the bottle of scotch on his
Sounds like
side.
a good time.
Well, it was. As you know, alcohol can loosen up a conversation. But he paced himself, and he was always lucid when he drank. But he did himself say that alcohol had become a kind of senior partner to his intellect, so that when he reached the age of 65, he found that he could no longer drink in the way that he once had. That happens to a lot of people. The body just rebels. And that, together with some other difficulties in his life, at that time, he was trying to write a long novel about World War II, and it just wouldn't cooperate. All of that together, I think, pushed him over the edge.
And the thing is that writing can be a source of frustration and depression at that, because according to some biographical information I came across, he said that writing is it's a draining process. It takes enormous amount of psychic energy. And that he doesn't even like to write, but he has to write. He doesn't like the process, but he has to do it. And he also suggested that he's indolent. Basically, my definition of the word is, that he's basically saying, I'm late. I'm, basically lazy. What about that whole that those few things there that it's very draining to write. Never helpful with depression when you're out of energy. And then he actually doesn't like to write, but he has to write.
Well, he was being a little disingenuous there, I suspect. While he was deeply engaged with a writing project, Styron was one of the most self-disciplined writers I ever knew. He had a regimen that he went through every day, in which he prepared himself to write, and he kind of eased up on the writing table. He kind of fooled himself, put himself into a trance. And then he would write steadily for 3 or 4 hours in the late afternoon, and usually would produce only perhaps 700, 750, 1,000 words. But those words would go directly into the book. That's not the usual thing that you find with writers. They write first drafts and then they revise and rethink and restructure. But Styron got it all straight in his mind before he sat down and picked up the pencil and addressed himself to the yellow pad. I do think what you said earlier is true, though, that the prospect every day of facing a blank sheet of paper, I don't know how writers do it. It really is a difficult thing, and I think maybe all of them do have to hypnotize themselves to get themselves to sit down and write.
Well, you're a writer yourself, so you've been through the process. You know that it's difficult. But you produce books. So,
I do, though in my case, I write biography, I write scholarship. There's always a structure to it, and there's an idiom that you use. I wouldn't really call it imaginative work. In some ways, the writing of biography is imaginative, but it's not the same thing as making up a story, making characters believable, seizing upon the images and the metaphors and the language that will make it all come to life. I always respected that about Styron. He was very dogged, self-disciplined, and he was a severe self-critic, so that if what he wrote on a given day did not suit him, he would destroy it and he would start again. That I admired about him too. His neighbor, Arthur Miller, the playwright, said of Styron that he carved his novels. I always thought that was an apt metaphor for how Styron wrote.
sculpting away. So the question becomes additive or subtractive. There's the people who produce a lot of words and they start to chisel away and distill them down to the words that really are useful and will be used, versus those who add. They don't necessarily produce a lot of track, as Julia Cameron would say. But then they just go through that additive process. I think Tom Robbins is a writer like that. It sounds like William Styron may have been of that style.
No, it's very true. As a matter of fact, to move back just briefly to Darkness Visible, his book on depression. In his papers at Duke University, I found five separate false starts of various kinds on that book. When you read the book, it looks as if it simply flowed out in a smooth and orderly fashion, as if Styron simply sat down and addressed himself to the blank page and perhaps in a month or so got it all down on paper. But it wasn't true at all. He had great difficulty finding the right voice in which to tell that story and to reveal himself in an autobiographical narrative. Of course, fiction writers reveal themselves in everything they write, but they have various disguises and ways of hiding themselves. An autobiographical novel or autobiographical account, on the other hand, is first person, and it reveals a great deal more than Styron probably was prepared at the beginning to tell about himself.
Now, he started writing as early as junior high school, is my understanding. He was just a voracious reader. I know that term gets used a lot, but he devoured books. He tried to read everything he could get his hands on, is my understanding. He wrote at Davidson College, but decided to go to Duke and became smitten by the idea of becoming a writer. And I guess there was a teacher at Duke named William Blackburn, who was a great inspiration to him. What do you know about William Blackburn?
I wish I had met William Blackburn. Everyone who knew him said that he was indeed an inspirational teacher, and that he opened up the beauties of language and literature to his students in a way that very few professors can do. He was, by all accounts, a rather grumpy fellow, a little standoffish, somewhat bearish in manner. But Styron himself, even as a young man, was private and standoffish and alienated. And so somehow these two found themselves and together. And Blackburn recognized that Styron had enormous talent and encouraged Styron. Styron was really not the sort of fellow who wants to be Mr. Achievement. How we were all trained in high school to follow along in the prescribed path of success. That wasn't his style. He was a lazy student, wasn't particularly interested in his studies. He was at Duke actually because he had entered the Marine Corps and for World War II. And the Marine Corps sent him to Duke where there was a unit that would train him to be an officer. So it was really a matter of serendipity, happenstance, that he should have met William Blackburn there, but it's a wonderful thing that he did.
Now, there's also this unspoken competition between Truman Capote, or at least it was in William Styron's head that he was competing against Truman Capote. Capote wrote his first book, or at least smash hit at age 23. I'm not sure, was that in Cold Blood that Capote wrote at 23? And then William Styron was obsessed with making sure that he wrote a novel by age 25.
I think the excuse me, the Capote book was Other Voices, Other Rooms. That was the one that introduced Truman Capote to the literary establishment. And yes, Styron felt himself in competition, but it was a friendly kind of competition. Actually, Those two men were good friends. They got to know each other in Rome when Styron was there as the winner of the Prix de Rome. He was at the American Academy there. And he and Capote went out one night. He brought Capote along on a date where he, Styron, met Rose Burgunder, the woman he would marry. As a matter of fact, Capote, who had a mina bird, a pet mina bird perched on his shoulder in this bar, he turned to Styron and he said, you really should marry that girl. And in fact, Styron did about 3 years later. So they remained good friends. And Styron very much admired Capote's ability. Of course, Capote was pursued by his own demons that eventually destroyed him. So I think anyone who could get along and be friends over a long period of time with Truman Capote deserves our admiration.
That's the truth. Yeah, he was not the easiest guy to get along with, and yeah, he big time drinker, and took the people around him and put them in magazine articles and books. And in fact, there's a series, I guess, I think it's on Netflix now, that where yeah, the women around him who he hung out with, he outed them in a book, told some true and embarrassing stories, and that was the end of that. Norman Mailer was another author who William Steinman had a competition with of a different nature. What about that, Jim?
Well, there was a long standing feud between Styron and Mailer. Though, according to Styron, it was more Mailer's doing that the feud seemed very important to Mailer. It was not so much to Styron. But Mailer deliberately picked fights with most of the writers in his generation. And Styron was among these. They lived almost as neighbors in Roxbury, Connecticut for several years. And they got to know each other up there. But they were fundamentally dissimilar people and very different writers. Capote is, not Capote, Mailer is at his best with this headlong improvisational style, all in the first person, and very much the observer, in many ways, a better journalist than he was a writer of fiction. Styron, on the other hand, was alienated and brooding and kept to himself and didn't reveal very much about himself. It's an interesting feud, though. It also has to do with some other people who were living there in Roxbury at the time, including a critic named John W. Aldrich, who wanted to be the guru of his generation, and he knew both Styron and Mailer and tried to get them together to be friends. Eventually, Styron and Mailer made up and decided to drop any kind of feud that they had had. Both of them went through difficulties later in life, and it brought them together. I interviewed Mailer for the biography of Styron that I wrote, and I liked him. He was funny. He was a raffish fellow, told a good story. Had a big ego, but that's all right. If you're going to be a writer, you've got to have a big ego. So I remember that interview as one of the high points of my work on the biography of Styron.
In fact, when William Styron died, Norman Mailer had some nice things to say about him. I thought I had a statement here in my notes, but I don't. I thought I had it here. But he was considered one of his peers, along with James Jones, Gore Vidal, and so on. Now, the what's interesting about William Styron, he writes two huge books, The Confessions of Nat Turner, about Nat Turner the slave, and then you've got and it became controversial. He writes Sophie's Choice, which has to do with World War II and Nazism and such. And that becomes controversial, to much to his frustration. I mean, let's start with the Confessions of Nat Turner. Here's the white man writing that story and very successfully writing it. And then the people who, some of the critics or some of the observers of the book said, you know, basically what a white man hasn't lived the experience, doesn't really have any business occupying this character. Talk, kind of frame what happened, Jim, and how William Styron responded to it.
Styron set himself the task of merging his own consciousness with an imagined version of Nat Turner's consciousness. Almost an impossible thing to do. And in fact, it seems to me now as I reread that book that it truly is impossible to pull off the narrative legerdemain that was required. But Styron felt it was necessary to confront the shade of Nat Turner directly. He could probably have avoided a lot of that controversy simply by changing Nat Turner's name to another name and setting the book in another part of the state of Virginia. But instead, he went right at it. And the reception of the book initially was very high, very positive. And then there was a backlash. This was, I think, one of the first instances in which African American intellectuals staked out their own territory. They did not want anyone else, particularly a Southerner, a white Southerner, to interpret their past for them. And we see this this pattern playing itself out again and again in the years that followed. I do think, though, that Styron was determined to cross boundaries of race. And later, with Sophie's Choice, of ethnicity, in order to bring his own viewpoint to what really are two of the great dilemmas of the 20th century in this country, indeed in the world, that's race and anti-Semitism. If he were looking for a smooth, a soft kind of reception, he certainly didn't go about it in the right way. But I asked him once, I said, did you ever regret, do you regret having written the Confessions of Nat Turner in the way that you did? And he immediately said no. No, he would do it again. He thought it was the only way for people to understand each other, that is to write about their shared history.
That, well, in fact, they Styron was accused of having misunderstood Black language, religion, and psychology, and of having produced a whitened appropriation of our history. That was from a New York Times obituary on William Styron, and according to the obituary, Styron became embittered, and he just decided to withdraw from the debate and just moved on to his next project. Which happened to be Sophie's Choice. Sophie's Choice also became controversial. He was also criticized for this, even though it's regarded as a great novel, was made into a very, very successful movie starring Meryl
No.
Streep. What can you tell us about Sophie's Choice? For again, frame what the controversy was and how it played out.
Well, I would say about the Confessions of Nat Turner that Styron was exasperated by his critics, but he certainly did not become embittered toward Black people. And he continued throughout his life to support the civil rights movement, and he never wavered from his belief that Black people needed to seek freedom. But yes, he was exasperated. With Sophie's Choice, Styron felt that he had to confront this enormous dilemma of the Holocaust, the Nazi Final Solution. The beginnings of that novel came to him in a dream. He dreamed about a woman he had known in Brooklyn in 1947. Her name was Sophie, and she was a survivor of the death camps. And from that dream, a kind of waking dream, the novel began. Styron had been struggling with his World War II novel, which he called The Way of the Warrior, and he never finished that book. He wrote reams of manuscript. It all survives. It's down among his papers at Duke University. I've read it all. But he was frustrated trying to write about World War II when this other story, this novel, came in and shouldered aside his efforts on the World War II novel. And so he simply took the inspiration and ran with it. He told me that and said in interviews that it was in many ways the easiest novel he ever wrote. That is, he felt fertile and imaginative. And the words went down on the paper with remarkable ease. It's a long novel. He spent about 4 years writing it. But it really is a very thoughtful novel, too, from a time when we still believed that creative writers could address these problems of society and have a kind of special insight to them. Now, I suppose we rely on newscasters and movie stars and politicians, but Styron didn't believe that. He wanted to have a public voice and wanted to do more than write tragic novels about the decadent South.
You mentioned Southern White Man, but as part of the controversy, regarding the Confessions of Nat Turner. He was born, Styron was born in Newport News, Virginia, just an FYI. Now, he started writing short stories. He started as a short story writer, but there was a gentleman named Hiram Hayden who convinced him to write novels instead of short stories. And even gave him money to write the novel. This is William Styron had a few different things happen in his lifetime that was so unusual for a writer, especially a new
Yes.
an emerging writer. So here's Hiram Hayden, hey, write novels, and here's some money that allows you to subsist while you are working away at this. Who was Hiram Hayden?
Well, Hiram Hayden was one of the great editors of his generation. He was the editor of the American Scholar, the Journal of the Phi Beta Kappa Society, but he also was a book editor for Crown and Bob's Merrill and Random House and Athenaeum. And he was a writer himself. He did not give that money to Styron. Rather, he arranged an advance from his own publishers to keep Styron going. It was Styron's father, though, who kept him going with $100 a month, which went a long way in the late 40s. Styron was living in New York City, but he was young and he could share a flat with a friend. And a lot of things in those years in New York City were free. That's largely where he wrote Lie Down in Darkness. It was a good thing, though, that he ran or the connection with Hiram Hayden was made, by the way, by William Blackburn, who was a friend of Hayden's. And Hayden became a kind of father figure, I suppose, to Styron when he was a young writer. Later, Hayden went on to other publishers, and Styron stayed with Random House, which was a very good decision on Styron's part. But Styron remained grateful to Hayden all through his life. As a matter of fact, he named his son, Styron named his son after Hiram Hayden.
And his son's name was what? Was it Hayden or was it Hiram?
No, it's Thomas Hayden Styron,
Gotcha.
the middle name.
So it was an advance, not it wasn't simply a handout of money. It's an advance. So it was a formal thing that a publishing company does. But typically, I mean, check me on this, Jim, but typically you get an advance once they say, oh, we've got this novel that you've written. We want to publish it. Here's an advance against a future royalties. He didn't even have the novel written yet. I mean, wasn't it a little bit unusual that they decided, let's go ahead and give him an advance now when he hasn't even written the novel?
No, he didn't, but he had the beginnings of a novel. He called it the name is escaping me, but the fragments survive, and that's what he showed to Inheritance of Night. That was the title. It's a good title.
Inheritance of
Night, Inheritance
Night, Inheritance
of
of
Night.
Night. Gotcha.
Yeah, another of those dark and foreboding titles. But yeah,
Yes.
a lot of people saw promise in Styron. He was obviously very good as whether he could get it all down on paper. And in fact, he did.
So he did have a what you might call a treatment or the beginnings of it. They saw the promise there. They knew where he was going with it. They knew of his talent. So okay, a wise obviously a wise investment because he actually made a lot of money on that first novel, is my understanding, Jim. We're talking about the title again is Lie Down in Darkness.
That's correct. A lot of money for that time. For instance, the paperback rights sold for $35,000, of which Styron got half. Well, it doesn't sound like a whole lot, but in 1951, 1952, that's a sizable amount of money. And in fact, one of the good things about Styron's career was that he never had to do odd job journalism in order to keep going. There are a lot of writers who have to take either a teaching position or review books or do travel writings, that sort of thing, to keep going. And then they write the novels with the left hand. But Styron never had to do that. He could concentrate himself on the novels themselves. And I think I'm correct that the advance for Lie Down in Darkness was the only one he ever received in his career. After that, the back royalties came in, and he was able to support himself that way. By contrast, the other writer I know probably the most about is F. Scott Fitzgerald, and his finances were chaotic. He was always asking for advances from his agent and his publisher. And really, if you study Fitzgerald's life, you get the impression that he deliberately put himself into debt so that he would go to the work table and sit down and get the writing done. And then he would write himself out of the red, and then he'd go through the cycle again. But you don't find that with Styron. He was much more orderly in the pursuit of his career.
Now, the way his books and William Styron's books have been described as his explorations of difficult historical and moral questions. So he was dealing with probably what you could call timeless issues, Jim, right?
He was very much an intellectual. You mentioned earlier, Mike, that he was a reader, and truly, at any given time, he had three or four books going, and it was not just idle reading. The way if I confess, I recently revisited Tom Clancy. And I just love Tom Clancy because he carries you along, and everybody is likable except for the bad guys, and the moral issues are very much clear. I like to read books like that, but Styron was reading history, biography, serious fiction by other writers. He read a lot of poetry. He had a well-furnished mind. And he thought of himself as a public intellectual, and he was. He actually did write a lot of journalism in the course of his long career, but that was not his primary aim. All of that reading went into the novels.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about his work style, Jim. He has said, "I feel dead in the morning." He's really an afternoon writer. I think his typical window for getting his work done was from 3 to 7 p.m. And I believe he was a night owl as well, although I don't know that to be the case. What about, I mean, does that ring true with you, the 3 to 7 p.m. afternoon writing? What else can you tell us about his work style?
Well, he had an odd regimen. He would, in a supreme affront to convention, he slept every day until about 1 p.m. So he had a big family and had four children, and there were dogs and pets and people who took care of the place, and his wife, who's a wonderful woman. And she managed all of that in the morning while Styron slept. And then he got up and read the New York Times and got himself going. Often in the early afternoon, he would take a walk. He always had one or two dogs, and he'd take a vigorous walk with them through the countryside. They had two homes. One was in Roxbury, Connecticut, and the other in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. He'd go on a long walk, and that would get him limbered up. And then he would sit down and write, as you say, in the late afternoon to the early evening. And then he would get up from the work table and come in, and he and Rose would have dinner. And he would stay up late, late at night, reading and thinking and for many years, smoking, though he eventually kicked that habit, and drinking, and then go to bed about somewhere around 3 a.m. Most of us don't have what would I say, the stamina to live that way, but Styron did. That's pretty much the way his days went.
Now, what about he socialized a lot though too, didn't he? Didn't they have they'd have dinner parties, they'd have fellow writers over, not just writers, but they my understanding is they were quite social, the Styrons.
They had a wide circle of acquaintance, and Rose It's one of the most gregarious, welcoming people I've ever known. She was just wonderful to be around her and to watch her. It all looked like it was spontaneous, but somehow she had a way of putting together these dinner parties and soirees and trips to the beach and shopping trips and things like that. Styron really came to depend on her to arrange their social life in that way. And she was very good at it. And she, for her part, sorry, she, for her part, acknowledged that Styron put the brakes on her tendency to bring in too much of the social life into their world. And so they struck a kind of balance between them. It was interesting to observe the times that I was there.
Now, William Styron did not plot his books. He didn't write an outline of not any serious outline. He would say that you start a novel with a vision. This is what worked for him. He had a vision, but not a plot. What do you know about that, Jim? Can you put some flesh on those bones?
Well, it's true. He kept it all in his head. With each one of his novels, he would keep a sheet of paper with a manuscript, and he would write down just a few words, kind of, it was almost like mnemonic devices or little triggers for his memory. And he would cover the sheet with these little bits of language. And then he would go from there and write. But I think he had general plot in mind, but he didn't plot out his novels in the way that, for instance, Sinclair Lewis did. Lewis was a great planner. He would do outlines and he would do notes and all that sort of thing. Writers work in different ways, but I will admit that, or remind us that Sinclair Lewis's style was wooden and his characters were caricatures. With Styron, he let the novel grow organically. And you can see this happening on his manuscripts. I've spent a great deal of time in my life going through his manuscripts and watching how the novels develop. He wrote always by hand. He could not compose on a typewriter. He was a two-finger typist. He used number two pencils and long yellow legal sheets. And it's almost as if those novels unscroll before you as you read them in the surviving manuscripts.
Now, you mentioned that the organic development of the novel, and Styron was a character guy. He believed that the character was paramount in the novel above story, and he believed in something called the autonomy of characters. Do you have some information for us on that, Jim?
William Faulkner once said that it was very easy for him to write a novel. He imagined a group of characters and he set them in motion, and then he just ran along beside them and wrote down what they said. I always thought that was, it's kind of amuses me to think of William Faulkner trotting along beside some of those tortured characters of his and writing down the dialogue. But yes, that was true also of Styron. I think he believed in spontaneity. You're exactly right that he believed in the autonomy of character. And thank goodness, because his novels, though they tackle very difficult problems, they are not didactic. you don't feel as if you're being lectured to, as if Styron is pounding a particular point home. It all comes to you in the guise of a story, and you absorb it in that way. That might be one of the reasons that it's possible to reread Styron's novels so successfully. A lot of writers, you try to reread them and you can't really do it. The second time through, there's not so much there. But naturally, in doing all the work on Styron that I have done over the years, I reread those novels and his other writings again and again, and they continue to yield up insights. They age very well.
The French were very fond of his books, I understand. Why was that? What was it about Styron's writing that the French found such affinity with?
Well, the French during the period of Styron's career were very much interested in Southern American writers. They had a long love affair with William Faulkner. And as a matter of fact, the translator of Faulkner's novels into French, a man named Maurice Edgar Coindreau, was Styron's translator as well. Coindreau was a professor at Princeton, and he read Lie Down in Darkness and was very much captured by it. And the same with Styron's second novel, Set This House on Fire, so that he approached Styron through the publishing house of Gallimard and asked for permission to translate those novels. Part of the success of Styron in France is owing to the elegance of Coindreau's translations. My French is quite limited, but even I, in piecing my way through the French translations, can see that what Coindreau did was not a literal translation, but a kind of reimagining in another language of what Styron had already created. All of that attention in France, though, caught Styron by surprise. He really did not expect it. And when the French began to react to his writings in the early 60s and his books began to sell and he became famous there, that was the beginning of a broader reputation in which his writings were translated into many other languages as well, including the Scandinavian languages and Italian, and even some of the Eastern European languages, Polish, for example. So that at his peak, he was world famous in translation. It was a dimension of his career that I think he could not have imagined when he started out all those years before.
Now, I assume E.L. Doctorow was a friend and an admirer because he wrote something for Time magazine after William Styron died. Now, I want to read this to you, Jim, and you can comment on any aspect of it. He hits a few different themes here, and I invite you to comment on whatever strikes your fancy. So E.L. Doctorow wrote, "Politically a liberal, he was in his craft a conservative, a painstaking writer with a southern gift for the elegantly complex sentence. He was a firm believer in the novel as a major act of culture. His novels were repositories of devastating moral history, slavery in The Confessions of Nat Turner, genocide and Sophie's Choice. His classic report of his own clinical depression, Darkness Visible, has served to hearten thousands who have suffered the disease. He stands tall in the pantheon of American writers of the past half century." End of quote.
Well, it's a good quote, and you're right. There are many aspects to what Dr. Rowe is saying there. Remember that Doctorow himself was a historical novelist too. He and Styron shared a desire to bring the past back to life. The central statement in what you just read, though, I think, is that Styron believed in the importance of literature, in the importance of the authorial voice, and wanted to have a voice in society, and did, in fact, have one during his career. It almost seems to me like a quaint idea these days. Styron believed implicitly in the power of the written word, and that carried him his whole career. He never lost that belief, even in the depths of depression toward the end, the many difficulties that he had in his last years. He believed in literature.
So William Styron ends up being hospitalized a few different times for depression. He had to knock it back on a few different occasions. As I said at the top, he never did, fortunately, take his own life. But he ended up dying at the age of 81, is of pneumonia, I believe it was. Is that right, Jim? Pneumonia that was a
Yes,
complication of
yes.
something else.
Well, of old age, things began to shut down at that time. But yes, pneumonia was the immediate cause of his death. But he was tough, he would fight his way out of those bouts of depression, and he would go back and he would write, and he would function well for a period, and then he would sink back in into depression. He had the support of a very strong family of Rose, his wife, and of his four children, and of an extended group of friends and associates, including his editor at Random House. Bob Loomis, a famous editor there, who Styron first met at Duke. They were students there together. And all of them supported him and kept him going. After I published the biography of Styron in 1998, I continued to see him. I would visit him once or twice a year. And it was difficult to see him suffer in the way that he did, but he always seemed glad to see me, and we had a good relationship. We were not pals or buddies, nothing like that. But he trusted me. That's the thing that I still am very grateful for. He allowed me to look at whatever materials I wanted to, as I was writing the biography, and he never tried to tell me what I should say. We had a good relationship. I would call him up from time to time, ask him some questions, and I would say things like, "Well, I married you off the other day. You and Rose were married in Rome, that would trigger his memories, and he would tell me some things he recalled from that experience. Or I would mention some of his friends, like James Jones, the writer. He and James Jones were very good friends, and that would set him off on flights of memory. I think it was pleasurable for him, even in depression, to go back and look at the past. Took his mind off his present miseries.
I can imagine. What drew you to William Styron? There's so many writers out there that you could have focused on, appreciated, written a biography about. The other person who you mentioned that you've done a lot of study on is F. Scott Fitzgerald, one of the greats. So why William Styron? What was it that drew you to him and kept you engaged?
It's always difficult to know. He and I had a lot of similarities in background. He was a native Virginian. I was a native Virginian. I am. I speak with an accent that was familiar to him from his boyhood. I say out and house instead of out and house. And we're both lapsed Presbyterians with a great respect for the King James Bible and the cadences of the beauties, really, of the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer. Beyond that, I'm not sure I can tell you. I read Lie Down in Darkness as a senior for a parallel novel and a course, very good course I was taking at the University of South Carolina. And then I wrote my senior thesis in spring of 1968 on the Confessions of Nat Turner, which had just appeared the previous autumn. So all of those things, I suppose, it's kind of a interesting sort of thing. While I was writing that thesis, I got Styron's address from a professor of mine, and I wrote him a letter and asked him some questions about Nat Turner. I really didn't expect a writer as elevated as Styron to answer. In fact, when you're an undergraduate, writers are these chimerical figures. You're not sure they really exist. The novels and collections of poetry emanate from the void, but is there a real person there? Well, about a week later, I got a postcard back from Styron in which he answered the questions, and I thought, huh, well, how about that? And then I went on along and began to do other work on other writers, but I always remembered Styron, and I got back in touch with him, I suppose 7 or 8 years later. I should probably mention this, that my first work on Styron was to be his bibliographer, not his biographer, but his bibliographer. And in order to do a elaborate bibliography of his writings, I built a big collection of his works so that I understood from the beginning going in how his work had been created and published and put out in the literary marketplace. I had a sense of his career, the structure of his career. That I think is important for any biography. Many of the biography, literary biographies I read, one gets the feeling that these books and essays and poems spring fully formed from the brow of the writer. Well, that's not true at all, but that's probably what I thought. That's what most undergraduates think. The biography that I ended up writing, I think probably the best thing about that biography is a sense of how Styron's career was put together and how it progressed, because there were long periods between his novels in which he published very little. But still, the structure was there, and I had it in my mind from the beginning.
Let me ask you as a closing question, Jim, how will William Styron, how has he been remembered, and how will he be remembered over the longer term?
I believe he will be remembered as one of the great writers of his generation, not only in the United States, not only as an American writer, but as a writer of the world, a citizen of the world. It's not unusual for a writer to sink into a kind of invisibility, obscurity, about 10 years after the death, and then to have a resurrection, a rebirth later on. That certainly happened to Fitzgerald, and it happened to Hemingway, happened to almost every writer that I have studied and cared about. Edith Wharton is another good example. James Baldwin, a very good example. So I expect there to be a rebirth of interest in Styron in the not too distant future. And when that comes, there's my biography, there are all of his works that are in print. His essays have been collected, his nonfiction is collected, his short fiction is there on the shelf. There's a very good edition of his letters that Rose, his wife, edited. And then both his Styron's daughter, his youngest daughter, Alexandra Styron, she wrote a very good book called Reading My Father, which is a memoir of what it was like to be his daughter. And then Rose published her own memoir last year. It's called Beyond This Harbor, a reference to Martha's Vineyard. And that gives you her angle on being Styron's wife. Though she had such a busy, such a varied life that there are many, many other things in that book. It's a delight to read. I think other people will continue to write about Styron. I hope another biographer will write about him and tell his story from a different perspective. That certainly happened with Hemingway and Fitzgerald and many of the other writers. There are something like 12 or 15 biographies of F. Scott Fitzgerald. They're all different. And most of them are good. So I welcome continued curiosity about Styron, and I hope that in my retirement I can encourage some younger scholars and critics to undertake the examination of his work.
My guest has been Jim West. He is professor of English emeritus from at Penn State University, and he is also a biographer of William Styron. He's written the biography William Styron: A Life. And in the episode notes, you can learn more about Jim West. I have a link to his website as well as a link to a site where you can learn more about William Styron. Jim, thank you so much for taking the time and filling us in on William Styron and his life and times. Appreciate
Well,
it.
thank you, Mike. I very much enjoyed it. I'm now 77, and I find I have become quite garrulous. I just go on and on and on. And so, thanks for the questions and for keeping us focused as we went along.